Even though I've already announced it on my website, I want to make sure I say it in person that you need to bring your own data link form to Friday's test. I won't have any extras, so if you forget, which in a class this big, certainly some people will forget, you're going to have to rely on the kindness of your classmates. The other thing is, I don't want anyone to be time stressed. So on test days, we'll start whenever you get here, as long as I'm here already, which means as soon as you come in the door, you can get a test from me and start immediately. That also means as you come in on test days, don't be loud. Don't be talking. People are already taking a test. Okay? So just come up to me and get the test form, sit down and take it. Any questions on that? By the way, if you don't realize it already, you can get the data link forms at the bookstore. Might as well buy 6 for the whole term. That way, when people forget, you will have an extra one to lend. All right, we left off last time speaking about prokaryotic cells, which are most cells, of course, but we are eukaryocentric. I made that up, of course, but that just means that we as eukaryotes tend to think about nothing but fellow eukaryotes. And so that's what the rest of the chapter is about, a survey of the organelles that really define eukaryotic cells. Yeah.
How many questions are on these cells?
All of them. There will be 50 exactly, and each of them will have 4 choices, A, B, C, D. So a eukaryotic cell, by definition, is one that has membrane-bounded organelles. That includes the nucleus, which is the basis for the linguistics of the word eukaryote. But in addition to a true membrane-bounded nucleus, eukaryotic cells have other membrane-bounded organelles as well. And we see those in slide 8, which is kind of a catch-all cartoon picture of an animal cell. Animals are just one type of eukaryote, of course. But we animals have this collection of membrane-bounded organelles. Not necessarily they're all going to be in every cell, but these are the ones. By the way, why do I know that this is an animal cell, even if it doesn't have a label that it's an animal cell?
No cell wall.
It doesn't have a central vacuole.
It doesn't have a central vacuole. It doesn't have a cell wall. It doesn't have chloroplasts. And where it's labeled centrosome, which is not this yellow thing, the centrosome is this cloud right here, this region. The centrosome has these two yellow things in it that are called centrioles. Plants, for instance, they have centrosomes, but they don't have centrioles. Anyway, we're going to look at these individually, so I'm not going to really mention what they do right in this picture, but I just wanted to make that distinction between animal and plant cells. Of course, animals and plants aren't the only eukaryotes either. There are all kinds of other eukaryotes as well, including fungi and various kingdoms of protists. But no cell wall on animal cells. A plant cell, on the other hand, like you see in slide 9, has all the animal organelles, at least in some of the cells, but in addition to that, has a cell wall, just like any cell wall, even in a prokaryote. The cell wall is material that's laid down exterior to the plasma membrane, and don't forget that every cell, whether it has a cell wall or not, has a plasma membrane. That's what really defines the cell. Of course, plants are photosynthetic, so they also have chloroplasts, the green ones, and, as you mentioned, a central vacuole, which you don't see in animal cells. By the way, the central vacuole is why some plants can grow so quickly compared to animals. animals have to build a lot of stuff in order to make new cells. A central vacuole takes up a large volume of a cell, and it's filled with just water mostly, which it can absorb rather than produce. And so you can add a lot of volume to a plant's body fairly quickly. While we were on the animal cell slide, I wanted to mention something but forgot. I did say that you'll have... Actually, I'll mention it in a different slide just so it won't be confusing. All right, let's go to 9 and start looking at things in individual detail. This is a very close-up view. This is an electron micrograph of part of the cytoskeleton. The cytoskeleton of a eukaryotic cell is a network of various kinds of proteins that form an infrastructure, basically. The cell is dynamic, always changing. And so things are moving around all the time in the cell. Things are always changing as far as being torn down and rebuilt all the time. But you have this network of proteins making up what we call the cytoskeleton, and we're looking at part of that right now. One of the three major kinds of proteins in the cytoskeleton are microtubules, which is what this thing, this rod-like thing looks is. And microtubules do various things, but one thing they do is serve as little roadways along which proteins called motor proteins, one step at a time, walk along, dragging things as cargo along for the ride. These vesicles that you see here are moving from one place in the cell to another because they're being carried on the backs of motor proteins that are walking along these other proteins called microtubules. We'll look much more detail at the cytoskeleton later, but that's just a glimpse. And in 11, what are we looking at here? These are chromosomes. Now, I suppose it's appropriate just to quickly compare chromosomes of prokaryotes versus eukaryotes. They both cell types have chromosomes, of course, because chromosomes contain DNA. The major distinction between prokaryotes and eukaryotes with respect to their chromosomes is that a typical prokaryote has a single chromosome, first of all, just one, and also it's a circular chromosome, which means it doesn't have any ends. What would be two ends connect back together to form a ring. It's not really circular unless you spread it out and made a circle, but it's continuous. Whereas in a eukaryotic cell, there's typically some plural number of chromosomes, which depends on the species. And each of those individual chromosomes, however many there are linear. So each of them has two ends. Also in eukaryotic cells, though, and as we can see this here a little bit, the DNA in a eukaryotic chromosome is just one major component. The other major component is a lot of individual proteins, chiefly histone proteins. Histones are a way for a eukaryotic cell to package its DNA into a much more compact but still organized form so that it doesn't just become a ridiculously tangled mess. Eukaryotic cells, in general, have a much bigger genome than a prokaryotic cell, meaning much more DNA. Not only more genes, but also more DNA between those genes, and so it's a lot more to keep in a small place. It's amazing that the amount of DNA we have fits in a cell to begin with. Not only that, it's packaged into a smaller nucleus within that overall cell. So histones really help in that, and what we see here are chromosomes, which is the name we give to the genetic material and the DNA and the proteins I talked about when they are in this highly condensed form. when they're in this highly condensed form, they're not, the DNA isn't really being used very much for transcription, or it's not being used for transcription. You see this only when the cell is just about ready to divide into two new cells. More on that later. Let's go to 12 and look at a detail of the plasma membrane. Plasma membrane, as we've discussed, is chiefly a phospholipid bilayer. I mean, that's what you have to have to start with to have a plasma membrane. That's what forms the semipermeable membrane. But if you had only phospholipids, then certain things that need to get into or out of the cell wouldn't be able to easily permeate that plasma or that phospholipid bilayer. That's one reason that you don't just have purely phospholipids. You need proteins embedded in membranes for various reasons, including for getting things into or out of the cell, but also there are enzymes that are membrane bound, there are markers, there are receptors for signals, all kinds of reasons why proteins are bound to membranes. And the purple proteins that you see here are membrane bound proteins, and you can see that maybe you can't see from this picture, but proteins that are membrane bound, even though they remain in the membrane, are not covalently bonded there to any of the phospholipids that are around them. And the phospholipids themselves are not covalently bonded to each other. The whole plasma membrane is described as a fluid mosaic because all these individual molecules can switch places continuously, like a crowd of people is not locked into position. What keeps a protein in a membrane, though, is that the bilayer has a hydrophobic region where the tails are, and hydrophilic layer on either side of that. And a protein, a membrane protein, has some sequence of amino acids, some of which are hydrophilic and some of which are hydrophobic. The thing that keeps the protein in that membrane, kind of buoyed or floating there, is that the hydrophobic R groups or amino acid side chains are going to be content to be around these tails, and the hydrophilic amino acids are going to be content to be around the polar heads. And that alone just keeps it there, basically, rather than making it go all the way out or all the way into the cell. It keeps it right there in the membrane. But in this C part, notice that it's not just proteins sometimes that are attached to this membrane. Sometimes the protein itself keeps it in the membrane, and then something else is attached to the protein, typically a carbohydrate of some type. So this is a glycoprotein. And I think I mentioned before that these carbohydrates, which you find facing exteriorly, serve as little identifiers to other cells of this same multicellular individual, for instance, saying, I am this kind of cell, or as ways to form bridges between two cells, and so on. In addition to having glycoproteins, though, a membrane will typically have glycolipids as well, not shown here, actually. But lipids that are in this membrane can also be attached to carbohydrate residues. Okay, 13. Close-up of the nucleus. And the nucleus is not only a membrane-bounded organelle, of course, it's also one of three multiply membrane-bounded organelle, meaning that it has more than one membrane. Each membrane, just like the plasma membrane, is a bilayer of phospholipids, but there are two bilayers covering the nucleus. That covering overall is called the nuclear envelope, but the nuclear envelope has an inner membrane, which itself is a bilayer, and an outer membrane, which is also a bilayer. It's two thicknesses of membrane. And the outer membrane, as you can see here in the electron micrograph on C, features a lot of what are called nuclear pores, little holes. Those holes are really formed by a complex of proteins. Each hole is a complex of proteins arranged in a circle, basically, with a hollow center, so that things can get into and out of the nucleus, for instance. I mean, of course. That's important because the nucleus, of course, its claim to fame is that it houses the DNA. And so where the DNA is in a cell is where transcription takes place. Transcription occurs, therefore, in a eukaryotic cell in the nucleus. That's just one part of protein synthesis. The other part is translation, which occurs where the ribosomes are. Well, in a eukaryotic cell, those ribosomes are out in the cytoplasm. So the nucleoplasm features transcription. The cytoplasm features translation. In order for both to happen, of course, you have to be able to export the product of transcription, which is that messenger RNA molecule. And therefore, that's just one type of thing that needs to be able to get through the nuclear envelope. That's why you have nuclear pores. Oh, by the way, I didn't mention the nucleolus, which is, don't be careful with that word because it's spelled so similarly to nucleus. But nucleolus is not a membrane-bound organelle. It is a feature of the nucleoplasm. It's a region within the nucleoplasm. Yeah. Well, there, it makes a passageway through both of them, but you're looking at the outer surface here. So anyone know what the nucleolus's job is?
Has information to produce ribosomes?
Yes. The nucleolus is the part of the nucleus where you find the genes. Genes are just DNA, but certain genes do certain things, certain genes do other things. This is where you find the genes whose job it is to code for ribosomal RNA, which you need to actually build ribosomes. So that's a specialized job that is clustered together, more or less, rather than just spreading these genes all over the genome, that they're brought together at the nucleolus. Chromatin, by the way, is just the name for the combination of DNA and proteins, which are in a chromosome, but in this case, it's not condensed, so we don't call it a chromosome, we just call it chromatin. It's loose, and therefore useful, or usable. Okay, now to 14. You should be familiar with this bean-shaped organelle, a mitochondrion, which is the singular. Mitochondria is plural. This is the second example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. A mitochondrion has two layers of membrane, just like the nucleus does, and they are descriptively called the inner mitochondrial membrane and the outer mitochondrial membrane. We'll look at this in much greater detail later in different chapters, but notice just at this point that the outer membrane, even though it's the outer membrane, actually is smaller than the inner membrane. It's just a smooth covering. It's about as big as it needs to be, whereas the inner membrane is highly elaborated or folded. So there's a lot more membrane surface on the inner membrane. And the folds in these inner membranes are called cristae, the plural of crista. This fact that the mitochondrion has two membranes actually subdivides the mitochondrion into two different compartments, right? There is a fully inner compartment, meaning inside the inner membrane, which is called the mitochondrial matrix. But there's also a separate compartment between the two membranes called the intermembrane space. And what is the major job of the mitochondrion? It does several different things, but what is its famous job? Well, it does produce ATP, but what is this elaborate set of biochemical reactions collectively called? cellular respiration, yes, that happens inside the mitochondrion. Glycolysis happens out in the cytoplasm, cellular respiration, which continues that process, or continues where cellular where glycolysis leaves off, that occurs in the mitochondrion. So that's how they look. In 15, we just see an example of a cell that has a lot of mitochondria. This is mitochondria. This is a sperm. They're active cells. They need to swim an enormous distance based on body lengths from their point of view to go up the vagina, through the uterus, through a uterine tube where they'll encounter an ovum or just die trying. So they need a lot of energy, and their mitochondria are fairly weirdly shaped compared to the typical bean shape. But mitochondria are in most eukaryotic cells in general. Eukaryotic cells have most of these organelles that we're talking about, if you just randomly pick a eukaryotic cell. And in your own body, more specifically, nearly all of your own cells have mitochondria. There's a notable exception, though. What kind of cells in your body don't have mitochondria? Red blood cells, erythrocytes. Good. And why does this make sense? Well, it's true what you say, but that's not really. There would be a reason, even if it weren't shape related, that you wouldn't want an erythrocyte to have mitochondria.
Erythrocytes have to base the oxygen
in it. Exactly. The job of a red blood cell, an erythrocyte, is to carry oxygen from one place in the body to another, to carry it from the lung to a tissue cell. Well, cellular respiration uses oxygen. So if you gave the red blood cells mitochondria, they would waste the oxygen that they're trying to carry to the rest of the body. So cellular respiration doesn't occur in red blood cells. Red blood cells work entirely on anaerobic fermentation. All right, 16. This is the third example of a multiply membrane-bounded organelle. This is a chloroplast. And we non-photosynthetic organisms don't have these, of course, but plants and other photosynthetic eukaryotes do. Now, photosynthetic eukaryotes haven't been around as long as photosynthesis. Photosynthesis first evolved in prokaryotes, and there's still plenty of prokaryotic cells that are photosynthetic. Well, they, by definition, don't have chloroplasts, but they do the job of photosynthesis similarly, just by elaborating their plasma membrane, the membrane that they have to work with. In a eukaryotic cell, there's specialized membranes for doing the job of photosynthesis, and those make up the chloroplast. So there's an inner membrane, an outer membrane, and what is called the thylakoid membrane, which is the greenish one here, that is also very highly elaborated, but in a way that makes the overall shape look like stacks of coins. Each stack, by the way, is called a granum, plural grana. But each individual granum, one stack, features many coin-like thylakoids. But all of these are connected together. So that thylakoid membrane really is all one membrane that has this shape that makes it look like a bunch of stacks of coins. And so there's a thylakoid space, which is the compartment inside the thylakoid membrane. There's an intermembrane space between the outer and the inner membrane. And there's also the stroma, which is the compartment that's outside of the thylakoid but inside the inner membrane. So there's really three compartments within a chloroplast. All right, well, we'll talk more about that when we get to the photosynthesis chapter. 17 now. What we're looking at here is a cartoon to illustrate the idea of the endosymbiotic theory to explain the existence of mitochondria and chloroplasts. So what happened is that before mitochondria or chloroplasts, there were really only prokaryotic cells. Some prokaryotic cells were aerobic, some were anaerobic. All right? And they were going about their business being prokaryotes, living among each other. Somewhere along the line, what we're calling here a proto-eukaryote, it's not officially a eukaryote yet, developed a nucleus, and it's really not shown here how, but really just an invagination or an infolding of the plasma membrane could happen gradually. And if that got deeper and deeper and basically surrounded the DNA, then you would have a nucleus. All right? That explains the nucleus, but that has nothing to do with the endosymbiotic theory giving rise to the mitochondria and chloroplasts. So you're on your way to being a eukaryote here, and this this proto-eukaryote engulfs cells. It's doing this basically as a way to eat, right? It's engulfing other prokaryotic cells. If it engulfs some aerobic purple bacterium, but for whatever reason that purple bacterium survives the process of being engulfed, and rather than just being digested, takes up residence in that bigger cell, then all of a sudden you have something that looks like a mitochondrion, and that will be doubly membrane bounded because the purple bacterium to begin with had its own membrane. And when it was engulfed by the bigger cell, that wrapped it into another membrane. Okay? And the fact that it's an aerobic bacterium explains why the mitochondrion works as an aerobic little unit. So there's all kinds of very good evidence pointing to this being almost certainly true. For instance, the outer membrane of a mitochondrion is much like the eukaryote. The inner membrane is much like a bacterial membrane. Also, there, a mitochondrion has its own set of DNA, which is circular and very much like a bacterium's DNA, has its own genes and it codes for its own proteins. It also, a mitochondrion reproduces by binary fission on its own, just like bacteria produce two new bacteria. So, pretty good evidence that this is what happened. Now, that would be the lineage that gave rise to us animals, eventually. Somewhere along the line, though, a member of that lineage also engulfed, later on, an ancient photosynthetic cyanobacterium. And for whatever reason, it survived that engulfing process as well. So now you already have a mitochondrion in here because that happened earlier. Now you have a brand new chloroplast as well. And the same lines of evidence point to this being true for chloroplasts. They have their own DNA. It's bacterial in nature. The inner membrane is like the bacterium and so on. Everything I mentioned is true for the mitochondrion, is true for chloroplasts. And so this would be the lineage that gave rise to all the plants, because they have mitochondria and chloroplasts both. So that's the endosymbiotic theory. Yeah?
Is a prokaryotic cell, would that still be a prokaryote?
Well, just temporarily. Proto means before. So it's on its way to officially becoming a eukaryote at this point. Until it gets these truly membrane-bound organelles, it's not technically a eukaryote. But this is, yeah, by here it already is a eukaryote. Yeah. Oh, yeah, I forgot to mention that. There's also, yeah, the mitochondria have their own sets of ribosomes, so that when they transcribe their own genes, they also have the machinery to make the proteins right in them, just like bacteria do on their own. All right, 8 to 18 now. We see the nuclear envelope again, which we've already discussed, although in this picture you can see what I said about it being a doubly membrane-bounded organelle. The main focus of this is a different organelle called the endoplasmic reticulum, and the reason the nuclear envelope is shown here as well is because the endoplasmic reticulum is continuous with the nuclear envelope. The outer membrane of the nuclear envelope, here and there, will evaginate, form an outpocketing, which is the official beginning of the endoplasmic reticulum. So we give them different names, but they're all continuous membrane. It's just functionally, they change functions when you go from nuclear envelope to endoplasmic reticulum. And I'm sure you already know or have already learned that the endoplasmic reticulum, which is an overall organelle, is broken down into two subdivisions, the rough endoplasmic reticulum and the smooth endoplasmic reticulum. Rough endoplasmic reticulum is so called because of the presence of a lot of ribosomes on the surface of that membrane. As we'll talk more about later, those ribosomes aren't always there. They just happen to be there. So if you take a snapshot of the rough ER, it looks rough because some ribosomes are temporarily situated there. They'll leave and new ones will come in. It's always changing. But in the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, you don't have these ribosomes studding the surface, and it also looks more tubular rather than like flattened sacs. But it's all continuous with each other. Smooth ER and rough ER is all the same membrane, just changing shapes and changing jobs. Now, it makes sense that the ribosomes stud the surface of the rough endoplasmic reticulum because its main job is to modify proteins that are being made at these ribosomes, and these newly made polypeptides are being strung into the lumen of the rough ER, where they will then, right after being assembled, be modified in some way and then sent on their way. Some proteins don't do this. They're made out in just on ribosomes that are just in the cytosol, and they're ready to go as soon as they're done. The smooth endoplasmic reticulum, on the other hand, has different jobs, various jobs, depending on the cell. But one major job, is the synthesis of lipids. And another major job is storage of calcium ions. These calcium ions, by being sequestered in the lumen of the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, will be kept away from the main cytosol. But if the correct signal is received, calcium ions can be allowed to spill out into the cytosol from the smooth endoplasmic reticulum, where those calcium ions serve as signals themselves. This is how your skeletal muscles work, for instance. But all kinds of other cells as well. Okay, now 19, we're still on the, we're onto the Golgi complex now, which is also a, as far as appearance is concerned, a system of membranes that look like flattened sacs. So it looks very similar to the rough ER, except for the near absence of ribosomes compared to the rough ER. It's also, though, situated right next to the rough ER. The rough ER, though, is interposed or comes between the nuclear envelope and the Golgi apparatus, or Golgi complex, or Golgi. They're called different things in different books. Golgi, Golgi complex, and Golgi apparatus all mean the same thing. Anyway, that's the order of things. You have the nuclear envelope and then the rough ER immediately, because it's actually continuous with it, and then right next to it, on your way toward the plasma membrane, is the Golgi complex. And the Golgi complex is, functionally speaking, a receiving and shipping center. It receives packages of proteins and other molecules in the form of vesicles. A vesicle is just a small bag made out of membrane. The membrane itself can be carrying things, membrane-bound proteins, for instance, that are actually part of that membrane. Or you could have other proteins that are entirely inside the vesicle. But where do these vesicles come from? The rough endoplasmic reticulum, largely. So the rough endoplasmic reticulum is continuously budding off pieces of its own membrane to form these vesicles to send packages of proteins to the Golgi complex. These vesicles then, since they're made out of membrane, will just kind of melt into the membrane that makes up the Golgi complex, and now the Golgi contains those proteins. And since they've been modified by the rough ER already, they might be ready to go, or maybe the Golgi will modify them even further. That can happen. But after having received these vesicles, the Golgi then determines, based on what the specific proteins are, where they need to go to do their job. So they will be packaged into new vesicles, which come from budding off pieces of the membrane of the Golgi itself, and those vesicles will be sent either to the plasma membrane, where it will meld with the plasma membrane and spill the contents out of the cell. Some proteins are destined for export. Or if they're actually in the membrane itself as a vesicle, that when the vesicle fuses with the plasma membrane, now those proteins will actually be part of the plasma membrane. That's how you get things into the plasma membrane. Or they can be shuttled to another membrane-bounded organelle via a vesicle. So that's what the Golgi does, basically. It receives various vesicles, makes new vesicles, packaging these proteins for transport to other parts of the cell or for export from the cell. And as a shipping receiving center, you know, you look at a building, shipping and receiving don't use the same door, right? You go to one place if you're delivering, you go to another place if you're picking something up. So the Golgi apparatus is a polarized organelle, meaning one side is different from the other. The receiving end is the side that faces the rough ER, which would be right here. That's where the vesicles are coming into the Golgi. And that's the cis face. It's called the cis face, CIS. The cis-trans notation that you're probably familiar with from chemistry. The trans face is where vesicles are budding off of the Golgi. That's the shipping side of it. It's sending it elsewhere. Yeah.
So, the vesicle is sort of like a box, right?
Yeah, it's just that it's made of membrane.
Yeah.
That's the important thing.
And the Golgi uses the box, but merges the box, right?
It'll receive these vesicles, first of all. And so now whatever the membrane is that made up those vesicles, that membrane is part of the Golgi membrane. And so the contents of that vesicle gets spilled into the lumen of the Golgi, gets modified maybe again, but in any case it gets repackaged based on what it is into a new vesicle that buds off of the trans face of the Golgi complex, and that's where it gets sent on its way, using motor proteins and microtubules like we saw earlier. 20. Well, we can see the three of these things that we just talked about all together now. The nucleus continuous with the rough endoplasmic reticulum. You can see the budding of vesicles off of the rough endoplasmic reticulum carrying these little purple dots, which represent proteins that have been modified by the rough ER. Those then fuse onto the cis face of the Golgi complex. They're now in the lumen of the Golgi, where it's Golgi is figuring out where these things need to go. It'll be packaged into brand new vesicles that bud off of the trans face. And this one happens to be a secretory vesicle, meaning it's going to be exported out of the cell. It's secreted. So this vesicle is going to fuse with the plasma membrane, which basically opens it up and spills its contents by exocytosis to the exterior of the cell. Other things, though, can be shipped elsewhere via these vesicles and stay within the cell. Lysosomes are next in slide 21. Lysosomes get their name from lysis, right, which means splitting, and soma, which means body, so it literally means a splitting body. A lysosome, to look at it, looks very similar to a vesicle, and actually technically it is a vesicle because it's a membrane-bounded little sac. But it does a totally different job from the vesicles we just talked about. Lysosomes are not for shuttling things around. Lysosomes get their name because inside the lysosome are a bunch of hydrolytic enzymes. Hydrolytic being the adjective of hydrolysis, right? So hydrolytic enzymes are catabolic enzymes, enzymes that tear molecules into smaller pieces by hydrolysis reactions. So lysosomes basically digest molecules into smaller ones. And the reason that the lysosome is necessary as its own compartment is that these hydrolytic enzymes are dangerous things to have around your body parts as a cell, right? Because these hydrolytic enzymes can tear apart the things that you as a cell are made out of. You only want it to be tearing down the things you're trying to digest. So these hydrolytic enzymes are sequestered safely in their own little compartment, the lysosome, where the lysosome will fuse with a vesicle that's bringing something in for digestion. When the vesicle, the endocytotic vesicle, binds to the lysosome, the two will meld. And so now that's how you get the material that's brought in from outside into the lumen of the lysosome, where that material is exposed to the hydrolytic enzymes and degraded, safely sequestered away from the main cytoplasm. Similarly, as in slide 22, you have what are called peroxisomes. Peroxisomes are also little vesicles, but they do a specialized job, indicated by their name. Peroxisomes deal with converting peroxides into water and oxygen. So they're filled with an enzyme called catalase, whose job it is to convert hydrogen peroxide into water and oxygen. Hydrogen peroxide is dangerous because it's very reactive, but it's a natural byproduct of metabolism. Metabolism at various points that we can talk about later produces what generally are called reactive oxygen species, or ROS, which contain free radicals. Free radicals are things that have an unpaired electron orbital, and that makes them greedily grab for electrons, basically. It makes them react with just about anything, including DNA, for instance. This is one part of aging, right? This is the big deal about antioxidants. Antioxidants minimize the dangerousness of free radicals, which can damage your DNA. If you damage other stuff, that's bad too, but it's not as bad as damaging the DNA, because other stuff can be rebuilt as long as you have the DNA, which is the instructions for how to build stuff. You start damaging instructions and then you're permanently damaged. So this would be much more of a problem if we didn't have peroxisomes dealing with this continuous, what would be a buildup, but continuous production of reactive oxygen species. 23 gives you a close-up view of a vacuole. Now, a vacuole is also a vesicle, really. It just happens to be a big vesicle. And since it looks empty, even though it's, of course, not space inside, it's filled with fluid, since it looks empty or vacuous, it gets the name vacuole. So you find these in plant cells, and there's typically a central vacuole, which it can be enormous in terms of a percentage of the overall cell's volume. That's what I was talking about earlier when I said that plants can seem to grow very quickly compared to animals. So a central vacuole, that is one of its jobs, is just to take up water and be a repository for other things as well. So this, the vacuole, the plant cell can dump things into the vacuole that it doesn't want to be in the cytoplasm. It can also house pigment, for instance. But we don't see these in animal cells. We see them in plant cells. Well, what we're looking at here is not a membrane-bounded organelle. Some books won't even consider it an organelle. Other books will say it's an organelle. It's just not membrane-bounded. But what we're looking at, of course, is hopefully you realize, is a ribosome. Any given ribosome, no matter what kind of cell you have it in, is made up of two subunits, small subunit and a large subunit. Now, the ribosomes that bacteria as a domain produce are, have slightly different subunits from the ones that archaea produces, which are slightly different from the ones that eukarya produces. So that's another, that's one of the bases I was talking about in that table for actually dividing it into three domains. But no matter which kind of ribosome you're talking about from any of the three domains, they work the same way. The small and the large subunit actually are modular, and they're usually not together like in this picture. Actually, this picture is a lie because you wouldn't see these together unless they were busy doing their job, which is for translation, right? The major job of ribosomes is translation. Well, the large and small subunit don't come together until you first have a messenger RNA there connecting to one of the subunits so that they can then come together as a full ribosome. And by modular, I mean that that particular small subunit is not necessarily going to get back together with that particular large subunit. They're all interchangeable as long as you get some large and some small together. And that happens for translation. We'll look at the details of that in a later chapter. 25 shows you the three major classes of proteins that I mentioned earlier when I talked about the cytoskeleton. We were looking at that picture of a vesicle being carried by a motor protein along microtubules. Well, microtubules are one of the three major categories of proteins. A microtubule isn't a specific protein. It is a category of proteins that makes up the eukaryotic cytoskeleton. The second category are microfilaments, and the third is intermediate filaments. Now, microtubules, we'll talk about all these again later, but microtubules are the biggest in terms of the diameter of the filaments, or the fibers that they produce, or that they are. Microtubules are the biggest diameter. Microfilaments are the smallest diameter, and that explains the why the third class is called intermediate filaments. They're midway in size. There's a lot of different kinds of intermediate filaments, but they're of medium thickness. And we'll talk about specific jobs that they do in a different chapter. 26 shows you specialized intercellular junctions or connections between cells that we find in plants, and these are called plasmodesmata. Now, the singular of that is plasmodesma. So this is just one plasmodesma, but there are many, many plasmodesmata between plant cells. They are little channels that connect the cytoplasm of one plant cell to the cytoplasm of the next plant cell. Small channels, and if you're a small enough particle, you can get through there. So it allows for communication between cells. This is how hormones can in plants can get from one cell to another, for instance. So if you think about it, since all the plant cells body, since all the cells of a plant's body have these plasmodesmata connecting them, the all of the cytoplasm of all the trillions of cells that make up a tree are really is one continuous compartment connected by these plasmodesmata. Animals have similar things. They're called different things, but we'll look at those in a different chapter. And then the final slide, 27, isn't about cells at all. These aren't cells, of course, because they're viruses or viri. A virus is not a cell because it doesn't have a plasma membrane. It's not an organism because it doesn't have a cell. It's much smaller structure. It's not living because it's not metabolizing. A virus is really just a couple biological macromolecules hooked together, right? Most viri, or a typical one, is a nucleic acid, which could be is usually DNA, could be RNA as well, though, instead. And then a protein, which really is just a wrapper for that, protecting that nucleic acid. And so you can see there are RNA and DNA containing viruses. They don't do anything on their own. But if a cell encounters a virus, it will connect to the cell. The nucleic acid will be injected into the cell, and then that host cell's machinery will be co-opted for the purposes of producing copies of new viruses. So they can't do anything on their own. They don't metabolize, but they are interacting with organisms, obviously, and can cause problems. So now you're armed with knowledge for Friday.